Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Anne Filippi, founder and host of the New Health Club Show. I like to invite you to change your mind about psychedelics because I believe we are entering a new era of health, bodies, and brains. And for this, we need new tools, experts, and thought leaders, which you can meet here at the New Health Club Show. Please enjoy. Hi, and welcome to a new episode of the New Health Club Show. What if your boss would do a psychedelic trip and then change practically overnight? At the moment, there are plenty of articles in Forbes, Fast Company, and Wall Street Journal about the so-called psychedelic leadership or the psychedelic CEO and how psychedelics would change the way we look at leadership. So how are magic mushrooms, LSD, or ketamine suddenly the drugs that power Silicon Valley? I wanted to know more about this, and luckily there's already research around the topic. So I recently had a fascinating conversation with Dr. Rochelle Sampson and Dr. Bennett Zellner, the principal investigators for the Connected Leadership Study, a research project examining the effects of psychedelic experiences on decision-making by organizational leaders. So what happens, again, if your boss takes LSD or if your boss goes on a psychedelic journey in general? Will he be a different boss afterwards? Designed for executive leaders addressing complex challenges, the Connected Leadership Program explores psychedelic potential to engender personal and collective transformation. Bennett and Rochelle and me, we spoke about such topics as the potential for psychedelic experience to help leaders to develop novel insights, as well as how psychedelics' ability to help people reconnect to others and nature might lead to more inclusive decision-making with a longer time horizon, which is what we actually really need right now. And of course, we talked about the big question, what is good leadership and who is a good leader in the future and what would need to change in terms of leadership. And yes, we also talked about Taylor Swift's leadership style, just letting you know. So please listen to our conversation to hear about these topics and more, including an upcoming Connected Leadership cohort beginning in June and also one later in the year. And it just opened for enrollment. All the info, of course, in our show notes. Please enjoy the show and our new ideas around psychedelic leadership. So finally today on the show, after a long period of contemplation between us, finally the amazing researchers team from the Maryland University, right? Rochelle Sampson and Bennett Zellner. And I think it's great if you guys introduce yourself first. Rochelle, maybe we start with you.
Oh, thanks, Anne. It's a pleasure to be here and finally have this chance to have this conversation with you. So my name is Rochelle Sampson. I am on the faculty at the University of Maryland in the Smith School of Business. And I'm trained as a lawyer and a business economist. And I have a fairly traditional start to my academic career, though I did work as a lawyer and a consultant once upon a time. And now I'm engaged in a project which I understand we'll be talking about shortly. But most of my work is in sort of the ESG space and in my research and my teaching, environment, social governance for firms. And is there anything else that you would like me to touch on, Anne?
Maybe you can already mention quickly the study that you guys are working on before we head over to Bennett.
Absolutely. So one of the projects that I'm deeply involved with and very excited about with my colleague and co-author Bennett, who's also here today, is the Connected Leadership Study. And this is a study that's examining the impacts of consciousness-expanding experiences on leaders, and specifically how it influences their decision-making in organizations. So really examining something which is a deeply personal experience and questioning whether and how this translates into a professional context. Does it actually influence how they make decisions? And does it lead to different kinds of decisions than perhaps would have been made previously?
Bennett.
So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Bennett.
Yeah. Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rochelle. And yeah, thank you to Anne. Really excited to be here today. Like Rochelle, I'm also trained as a business economist, and I also teach on the faculty of the Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. And I started off as more of a kind of traditional business economist, and my interests shifted over time. And my focus today is on an emerging field known as regenerative economics. And I'm currently doing work, some of which Rochelle has already discussed a little bit, at the intersection of regenerative economics, leadership, and psychedelics.
So you guys are doing this
We're doing the study together.
Study together, right? And I mean, we can say it's kind of the first really big study around a very new topic like this, right? I mean, this basically the premier, just kind of the first trial around this or the first study. There was nothing comparable.
Yeah. I've seen some kind of survey pieces where, you know, leaders have been surveyed afterwards, but never in a kind of an intentionally designed study yet. That hasn't happened yet. And I'm aware of, you know, some other researchers that are interested in this area, but to our knowledge, this is the first of its kind.
Okay. Right. So, I mean, we talked about the idea of leadership quite a little bit in the preparation for this podcast. And in my perception, coming from the entertainment world, it's often that the most successful, one of the most successful TV shows are kind of showcasing very bad leadership, meaning that people really seem to enjoy this. Like, I mean, Succession won a lot of Emmys, like the worst character. He got the most Emmys. Mad Men was kind of, okay, we want to call it like leadership from the 60s and 70s, just to realize that it's still the same leadership like today. And also The Sopranos. I mean, it's funny, but it's also cruel. I mean, there was a psychiatrist involved, but still. And so what would you answer somebody who says like, well, this is obviously what we in the Western world see as leadership in these shows?
May I go? Yeah. So, I have not seen, I'm behind on my TV. I haven't seen Succession, and I did watch a few episodes of Mad Men many years ago. I watched The Sopranos. My impression from my limited exposure to these shows is that the type of leadership, you know, you use the term bad leadership, and I might characterize the leadership on those that's kind of exemplified by those shows as sort of a caricature of a specific form of leadership. And we might think of this as kind of patriarchal leadership, or maybe another term we could use is heroic leadership. So this is this conception of leadership where you have an authoritative individual who directs others according to a master plan. And, you know, if we kind of step back, first of all, I think there are much more sort of evolved forms of leadership other than this kind of extreme caricature. But, one argument that has been made is that form of heroic leadership, that form of patriarchal leadership, embodies many of the same kind of values and ideas and patterns that animate our entire economic system and our entire culture in some ways, and that some of these patterns and ways of doing things are problematic and have contributed to some of the crises that we now face. So I could say more, but I want to, I could just pause there too. And I don't know if Rochelle, if you want to add or.
Well, I agree with everything you just said, Bennett. And I have the similar caveat in that I haven't even watched a few episodes of Mad Men. I've seen The Sopranos of those shows. And I guess I have two thoughts around it, not being an expert on this pop culture by any stretch, is that, you know, part of the reaction to it, which I think is what you were also asking about, Anne, is, you know, it's like watching a train wreck. We can't avert our eyes, you know, even though none of us want to be on the train wreck. None of us want to be in the train wreck. We don't know, want to know anybody who is on the train wreck. But there we are, eyes glued to it. And so I think there's a certain element of that too. But, you know, I also want to point out, and there is a show that I did watch, which exemplifies a different kind of leadership, which is Ted Lasso, which was wildly successful. I don't know if how successful it was in Europe. But what was interesting about it is that it portrayed a very different style of leadership. And it was still incredibly popular as a television show. So in some ways, it was kind of a proof of concept of, you know, can we be entertained by something that's not a train wreck?
Maybe it's not my kind of show, and I watch all the train wreck shows. It's also possible that it's my trauma speaking up here. Yeah. More looking at... yeah, sure. Tell me.
Yeah, sorry, because... So I haven't seen Ted Lasso, but I've heard lots of... I know lots of folks who like that show too. And I just wanted... I think Rochelle's point is an excellent one. And I just wanted to add something to it, which I think is relevant to the conversation that we're having, which is that... So there is this kind of old style of leadership that we've been talking about. And we now see some examples of a potentially different type of leadership. I think that is a broader conversation that's going on. It, recognizing all the crises that we, you know, that we face, I think there's a feeling that we need some form of leadership to help guide us out of the crises. But the type of leadership that led us into the crises is probably not the same type of leadership that's going to guide us out of them. So the research that we're doing, it's a research study. We're objective. We're examining what happens, but it does have the potential to speak to this broader conversation about what type of leadership might arise or might evolve to help us navigate toward a brighter, you know, more regenerative future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, like, this is kind of almost like the way we describe these TV shows. It's basically what is happening, like you say, right now. And it's like, it feels like the stage is obviously set in so many, on so many levels, that old leadership is really bringing more harm to the table or to the world than any kind of new leadership. I mean, we could, if we would go into details now, we would spend the next hour just naming horrible scenarios that are happening around the world. So before we maybe talk a little bit about the study design, maybe just to summarize a little bit, like a lot of times if you read in media about psilocybin and mushrooms, it's like makes people more empathic, it makes them more open, understanding other people. It kind of makes them, I mean, you could say a better person. The ego death is coming if the dose is high enough. So you're not so full of yourself anymore, which comes in handy as a new kind of leader. So at the same time, since, you know, as we know also in psychedelic trips, it's not only that we make kind of encounter like our good side. We also make friends or encounter our shortcomings, our bad sides, our shadow work. Like this kind of expression comes off and on. So maybe you can talk a little bit about how you set up the study in terms of finding out more positive traits in leaders versus more traits that should maybe eventually disappear in a leader.
So I guess I'd like to back up just for a moment.
Sure.
From
yeah,
that.
Sure.
That it's a super interesting question about almost like trait resilience and how resilience are traits, you know, of individuals, how amenable to change are they? But I guess even before that, you know, as we were thinking about this study and designing it, we sought to kind of really sit with, I think, what's at the heart of your question, which is, what is it that might actually precipitate a change in how someone makes decisions in an organization from a leadership position, right? And what is it about psychedelics that could precipitate that from what we know on the research? And you mentioned a number of outcomes that happen, right? Such as shifts in empathy, et cetera. Self-awareness is another big one, right? And those we know are very important in leadership, right? So, but the other that we have been examining is one of the key mechanisms is perceptions of connectedness. So the research has shown that individuals who take psychedelics in these controlled settings, one of the mechanisms by which it has had an impact on clinical outcomes, which has been the focus of most of the research, is because of its impact on, you know, say, leading to greater perceptions of connectedness with themselves, with others, with the world. And one can imagine that if that's true, that it is going to lead to a different kind of decision making. Because if you are able, in a nutshell, there's more to it than this, but if you're able to, in a nutshell, perceive yourself as connected to all things, then the decision making shifts in its nature, and that it's not just potentially this kind of more mechanistic decision of A leads to B, but it becomes potentially a more holistic evaluation of, say, all of the affected parties, such as, you know, it's not just about the bottom line, which maybe we could think of as an investor focus, but it becomes about the workforce, the community, the environment, all of these groups that are relevant and important for firm value too, I might add, but sometimes over the medium to longer term instead of in the short run. And so that's really the question that we're examining is, you know, through this kind of mechanism of connectedness and some other pieces in between, do these experiences then shift this behavior, right, around decision-making? And you know, Well, I'm sure we'll get into it a little bit more, and I want to turn it over to Bennett. But what we observed in the pilot is that, you know, and it's very small numbers with this that our pilot concluded last summer, is that this does seem to hold some water, that there are these shifts in connectedness, and we do see a relationship between that and out, and, you know, sort of shifts in outcomes. Mind you, the timeline over which one examines those outcomes is extraordinarily important because it's not always immediate. It sometimes can take a much longer arc to really manifest. Bennett, I'm sure you have.
Yeah, and that, I think that was a great, I don't have much to add to that. It's an excellent description of, you know, what we're trying to do, basically understand whether and how these personal experiences of connection or reconnection might translate into professional transformation. I would maybe just add one framing comment. Rochelle used the word mechanistic, and I think that's a very important concept. So we were talking earlier about kind of patriarchal or heroic leadership, and the pattern of which that is a part is a mechanistic pattern. It's a way, and this kind of goes back to the Enlightenment and the reaction to, you know, just kind of a reaction to religion and metaphysical ideas and all that kind of stuff. And so there's been this kind of mechanistic orientation, this mechanistic attunement, this very reductive way of looking at the world that's associated with science. And science has clearly been a great thing, and we've had lots of incredible advances as a result of it. But this mechanistic kind of reductive viewpoint also in many cases ignores or underemphasizes the connections among the parts. And so that's one of the reasons why the ability of psychedelics to help people connect or reconnect is so interesting to think about in this context, because there is a sense in which a more connected attunement or a more connected orientation is kind of a counter to arguably some of the some of the ways of thinking that have led us into the current situation. And I guess the last thing I would say is that the pattern of life itself is a mutualistic pattern, although at every single level, it's a pattern where not only are the connections important, but there's a mutuality in the relationships. And so I think that we all have, I'll have an understanding of that at some level, but because of this very reductive mechanistic way of thinking that our culture teaches us, we may have forgotten that in some cases. So is it possible to help people reconnect to the fundamental pattern of life, this mutualistic pattern of life? So I hope that makes sense.
No, it makes sense. But I mean, what's interesting, and I mean, this also happens in trips outside of, let's say, something like your study or the first round of people who are founders and leaders trying this out. So a lot of people reconnect also with their, let's say, intergenerational patterns. We could be more precise and say Germans reconnect with a very strict leadership style that most of them carrying inside of them without knowing that they do. And so suddenly, and I had a conversation about that with a lot of some German people who've done a psychedelic experience in the past, that they suddenly realize how much actually, let's say, the epigenetic situation influences them way more than, for example, gender, or that they're just repelled by certain leadership styles from their past or from their country, and that's why they would not take responsibility for leadership, which could be also something very positive, leadership. So, and because some people, if they hear the word leadership, it's like, oh, what do you mean? Somebody tells other people what to do. It's not necessarily that. So in what way is the study looking into, let's say, intergenerational material, which is very different from very much like a lot of nations, and plays immediately into something like a diversity officer at a company, which never seems to work out, what I hear from a lot of people, which I find super interesting.
Good question. Fascinating question. It's a fascinating question. I guess the short answer is we're not examining that directly in the research. Mm-hmm. Of course, there is a lot of, the early psychedelic research of Stanislav Grof that looked in this kind of transpersonal work, which is a little bit of, I think, what you're describing. Those things are difficult to measure. But I would almost describe it as it's a kind of identifying the water we swim in, and being able to really have awareness of that. And so in that sense, because of what we know about psychedelics and their ability to raise self-awareness and kind of just giving that gap between kind of what's going on, what's coming up for someone and the reaction to it, like the little bit of the depersonalization, then that offers an opportunity to step away from whatever maybe we could call it transpersonal, we could call it social conditioning, we could call it cultural conditioning, right? There's a lot of different ways we could describe it. But in any event, the impact is the same. It can lead to unconscious behavior, right? And so the ability to have greater self-awareness, we think, is a chief mechanism by which it can lead to shifts in leadership because suddenly one becomes more aware. But that is very individual journey, right? So you described the German experience, right? American experience will be different, and it will be different depending on who you're asking, right? Experience is going to be very different than, say, for Bennett, for someone of another race who's born in America, not born in America, And so all of those are interesting. And I think what we've been really focused on are identifying more universal mechanisms that can apply across those different contexts and backgrounds, but still are picking up kind of that fundamental kernel, right, of change, right, which you were describing before.
Yeah, I think that everything Rochelle said is, of course, I completely agree with. And yeah, I think it's important to emphasize that we are not trying to teach some new form of leadership. The setting for the study creates what we hope feels like a very safe container for people to do the type of exploration that Rochelle is talking about. And it is possible, and this is, of course, what we're examining, that in that space, new ways of being and new ways of leading will arise. And if we want, again, if we want to link it back to this kind of broader kind of systems change context, that to me is, there's hope in that. You know, so the people who are in positions of leadership now have a tremendous amount of economic, social, and political influence. And so they really have the potential to act as force multipliers. And so if they through their own personal process are able to move into a different way of being, then I think there's a tremendous amount of potential for what they, from what might come out of that for the benefits, not just to them, but also the potential benefits to a much broader swath of society. So that's.
And can you, Bennett, explain what exactly the restorative aspect is? I think a lot of people try to understand what it is, but what it actually means for economy.
I think you mean regenerative.
Regenerative.
Which is a similar. There's restorative.
Why do I
keep
saying restorative?
That's okay. It's all
regenerative.
Good.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the easiest way to think about it is that arguably, not everybody would characterize it this way, but arguably, the pattern of our current economic system is an extractive pattern. It's a pattern in which the institutions of the system, the structures of the system, all support the extraction of resources from bottom to top and from periphery to center, primarily for the benefit of one concentrated group, financial shareholders, above all others. And that kind of extractive pattern, these one-way flows, is the opposite of the way that natural systems work. Natural systems work by circulating resources to support the thriving of the system and its ability to keep on regenerating itself in the future. You know, one good example that I've heard it involves the human body. This is from someone named John Fullerton, so give John credit. But he talks about how, if you look at, take your toe, the heart helps to, pumps blood to the toe. It's not doing that to be nice to the toe. It's doing that because when the toe functions well, that's also good for the heart. It's good for the whole system.
Yeah.
And he refers to this as empowered participation. And the idea behind a regenerative economic system, it is exactly that, to look at the way that these natural systems operate and try to imagine an economic system that would operate that way as well. A system where the focus is on the thriving of the system rather than trying to maximize the benefits for one part at the expense of others, which in the long run hurts the entire system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And may I layer an example over
sure,
that
of
too?
Course, yeah, sure.
So there's a way of thinking about it that I think is more simplistic than the more sophisticated way and nuanced way that Bennett's talking about it, which is a very common, increasingly common kind of practice is like cradle to cradle design is what it's called, or the circular economy as it's called, and the idea is, as you would imagine. So rather than, say, a product cradle to grave, starting with extraction and development of materials, manufacturing, shipping, end use, landfill, right? It's a linear process. You take that and you do what we call close the loop, which then once you do that, The idea is that every material that you're putting out into the world, say as a manufacturer of stuff, has to be able to be broken down either in the, this is the cradle to cradle nomenclature, either this kind of biological or technical nutrient. But the whole idea is that the biological can break down into compost, right? The technical can be infinitely upcycled. You know, aluminum can be made back into an aluminum can, right? You know, it's that kind of idea that it can be constantly being remade. You use renewable energy. But once you have to take back materials, you completely redesign your products, because you're not going to take back anything that you're not going to be able to break down into its constituent parts, right? So it leads to a complete shift in design thinking, in how you actually even design the products to begin with. So, you know, imagine the shift if every manufacturer had to take back products at the end of life. You know, that's a mountain of products. You better have find something to do with it, right? Ideally to make into new, more of the same products. And that's a challenge. And so that's kind of like on a, you know, like what this can look like. But then what Bennett's adding to that is something deeper and more holistic, which is, you know, the example you gave of the toe, you know, and the heart pumping
blood.
That's
a good example. You understand it.
Right. Right. That it's, you know, helping all parts to thrive is good for everyone. Right. And, you know, that's kind of like an even bigger way of kind of conceptualizing it. And I'm just giving this kind of smaller microcosm of what this might actually look like. But it's this idea that you're kind of closing the loop, that there's none of this sort of cradle to grave kind of thinking and, you know, sort of generating waste all along the way. And but there is this more holistic component that is the regenerative layer on top of it. And that's what makes it different from, say, traditional just sustainability.
I love that. And first of all, I love your example, Rochelle. And if you like the toe example, it's John's anyway. So feel free to use it. I'm just going to add one point to that, just to link it back to something that we talked about earlier. This kind of, in the way you described the example, Rochelle, you were talking about kind of the more traditional way of designing products and, you know, yeah, there's waste and all this kind of stuff. And that way of thinking about things, that way of orienting toward the world, reflects this kind of mechanistic attunement that we were discussing earlier, where we look at nature as a bunch of resources in reserve to see what we can extract out of them. And so it's a complete shift in orientation. So yeah,
I also want to kind of add to that this idea that taking care of the system takes care of the parts in the kind of like the following example. So there's a very famous example of this kind of shift of kind of this cradle to cradle design, and it's this company called Interface Floor, who, Bennett, you probably know, they make these square carpet tiles, right, in the U.S. I don't know if they have that in Europe.
I use them. Yeah.
Anyway, so their founder, Ray Anderson, very famously had an epiphany. You know, we're sending tons and tons of carpet to landfill, and this is a disaster for my grandchildren. And I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, and then he just decided that they were going to completely change how they did business. And so what they said is, okay, we're going to take back all carpet, you know, and what would that mean, you know, in terms of design and such. And so, you know, they had to redesign some of the fiber so it was infinitely upcyclable back into carpet and things like that, and put in all kinds of mechanisms. But the surprising part to them is that reduction in waste and, you know, reduction in input costs and things like that accounted for something like 40% of their profit in a down year, when otherwise they would have been really struggling financially. And a lot, I'm not saying that this happens to every firm, but oftentimes it does. And it's very surprising for the parties that are involved. They thought they were doing it for purely altruistic reasons, but lo and behold, it actually benefited the system and its parts in ways that were actually good for the bottom line ultimately. And that's the part that's sometimes the surprise, that firms are not always, don't always have on their radar.
Yeah. But I mean, like, this is already a very good example, like, of an, you know, the leadership makes a different decision and the whole system is transformed in a good way because he thought of his grandchildren. but I mean, of course, we see also in the media about the reporting now on, there are some companies, I mean, also Sherry Rice does great work with Anthea, like offering eventually psychedelic assisted therapy for companies to offer this to their employees, which is something that is, you know, I mean, it's like in 5 years, this won't be really weird at all anymore. It's really, you can see it. But still, of course, people would already now think of like, okay, what if, let's say, the leadership engages in psychedelics, which we see in a couple of extreme cases right now, where the leadership engages in psychedelics in an not very responsible way, of course. But still, this is something we see right now, where we see like, oh, is this how it is going to look like, for example? So, but back to my question, or like to what most people immediately would come up with a question, is like, what if, let's say, the leadership does engage in this? And first of all, kind of either decides to close the company because they no longer feel like a CEO or like a founder, or they kind of change direction like 100%. And the investors would be like, wait a minute, we gave you the money based on so and so and so, for example. So, I mean, this would be like kind of the first questions that most people, not looking into psychedelics as something that could enhance your kind of success or like better leadership style, would immediately come up with and say, like, let's say, even I could even imagine some investors saying, putting in their their contracts, well, before you go on a trip, let us know, kind of, for example. So what do you think about the problem around this kind of unpredictable outcome also with the leadership, right? I mean, because we can't say, oh, this guy's going to be super nice after the trip. It could be also say that this guy says like, I never have a company in my life, although I just raised $500 million.
Right.
So I know you can't answer this all at once, but it's something that I keep thinking about a lot. So
I do have some thoughts, but Bennett, okay. If you wanted to, did you want to jump in first or?
Either way. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily a bad
say
outcome.
It.
I don't. Yeah. There are. This is putting it more into like the moving outside
no,
of the
say,
research
say,
more
you,
into
you can
kind
say
of systems change.
Like,
but yeah, I mean, if systems change is going to happen, it's going to require, there are going to be some pretty big changes, and those will probably involve some organizations closing and other new organizations arising. So I don't see that it's inherently problematic at all.
It's almost like it has to happen at one point.
Yeah. You're pointing to some governance issues with investors. Like, so if investors are concerned, they can set up governance structures to protect themselves, but that's kind of a separate issue. You know, I don't think there's any issue with the fundamental kind of shift that we're talking about. That's all.
And I would add to that, you know, while perhaps this kind of therapy, you know, psychedelic assisted therapy, or as it were, may be more precipitating in terms of events, the reality is that people experience these transformative events in many different flavors that causes them to rethink their lives. You know, medical diagnosis, death in the family, you know, all kinds
divorce.
Of things like, divorce, health issues with the child, you know, loss of a job, you know, all kinds of things can cause them to completely do a 180 that have nothing to do with this kind of intervention. And so and I will also say that, so I'm also an executive coach, and, you know, one of the agreements
if I'm ever working with an organization, is, you know, being really transparent about that as a possible outcome. You know, it's entirely possible in coaching someone that they realize this is not the place that I thought I wanted to, you know, where I wanted to be, that this mm-hmm. is not feeling in alignment with who I'm discovering myself to be, or that I'm not sure. Some organizations actually embrace that because for them, it's similar to what Bennett's saying. Maybe that's not a bad thing. And sometimes it's not so much that there's something wrong with the organization. It's just not a fit for that individual. And, you know, it's better to find that out sooner rather than later in many respects. I mean, it can be disruptive for sure. And I don't want to downplay that. And of course, psychedelics have their own potential for disruption, you know, mm-hmm. particularly if they're, you know, not, it's not in safe spaces. You know, we see that, you know, it's a little bit why research was shut down for such a long time, mm-hmm. is there was a cavalierness
exactly. yeah.
around yeah. psychedelics and people. And there was some harm. And so it's not that they aren't or can't be disruptive. It's really just being very thoughtful about what that means and, you know, kind of providing the structures around. And as Ben had mentioned, you know, for people who are in leadership positions, you know, particularly the most senior, governance structures are important, right? You know, and then it brings up questions about what's the right demarcation between personal and professional lives? Are they required to tell the board when they get divorced?
Well, that's a very interesting question. As just Bennett, before you answer the thing, it's something that my favorite shows show very well, that it has all an impact on their leadership style. Like every private incident, you know, like the son saying, I hate you to their father. The wife is saying like, oh, I'm getting a divorce. So it totally has an impact. So, but Bennett, sorry, you wanted to answer that.
All I was going to add, and first of all, I agree with what you just said, Duane, by the way. And I think that, you know, one can generalize from that there is behavior that shows up in the leadership domain that is deeply, deeply influenced by unresolved personal traumas or insecurities, and that can play out in lots of different ways. But the point that I wanted to make earlier is, I think in some leadership development work, there's at least an implicit assumption, maybe by those who are seeking, you know, who are going into it, that the goal is to make them better, more efficient, just to basically kind of hypercharge them to work toward the same ends they're already working toward, which in our system, shareholder profit maximization is kind of the default for that. One question, however, that I think sometimes arises is when one enters into, has a consciousness expanding experience, is a question that they haven't considered before, which is where am I actually trying to lead to, or where do I want to lead to? So it's this question of lead to where that maybe, you know, it's, I think that's kind of a little bit what you're asking about. People might be considering that question for the first time in some cases and possibly didn't expect it. And, you know, again, I think that's actually a good thing. I think for us to kind of step back.
Like, for who am I doing this? You know, like the carpet guy, like, do I think of my grandchildren?
Why? Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going to bring in one other thread here, if that's okay.
Sure.
Which is, you know, so there's two ways that we're starting to see this being potentially offered, you know, within organizations, right? So one is around mental health, which is what you described, Anne. And that's kind of in one bucket. But then there's the other, which is around creativity. So it's an interesting phenomenon because, you know, we can look back and say there are some extremely important discoveries that one can tie to psychedelic use, right? By some incredibly brilliant scientists and inventors over the last century, right? This is not
always
new.
Yeah.
Right?
Writers, philosophers since 5,000 years, 6,000 long ago.
Yeah. So, but household names, right? And so yeah. I think that creates a perception of if we offer this in a team or whatever within our organization, that people are going to become more creative. And yes, that's a possibility. But it's also true that most of the individuals who get profiled, who we know, you know, there are these linkages, already had these problems that they were sorting, these technical, scientific, design-based problems and questions, kind of at the heart of their being. Like it was like their calling and passion, and, you know, and it wasn't selling more whatever, you know, of this particular company. It wasn't necessarily how do I make this particular organization more successful. Sometimes it is because that's their company, right? And so it becomes one and the same, but that's not always true. And I feel like I'm a little bit opening Pandora's box here, because it's opening a whole sea of messiness, which is questions on when does it help creativity and when is it not in service of that? And can one really direct it in that way? When is it really more about just kind of well-being of the individual, et cetera? And I don't know the answers to those questions, but I just wanted to bring up that those are kind of two ways that we're starting to see, you know, psychedelic-assisted experiences or therapy being brought into organizational contexts.
But isn't it also like almost like this, it turns out to be true so many times that if you don't attach outcome to your productivity and creativity, like Steve Jobs, I mean, he's still the best example. He didn't want to, I mean, of course, he wanted to sell computers, but in the first place, he wanted to create a world that we still are addicted to today. Everybody's buying these, you know, Vision Pro thing. And people go, all of you, I guess. So, and it's still like, I sometimes think like, wow, this guy is still kind of doing this trick, like from wherever he is, because people completely go bonkers when there is something coming up from the Apple universe. And I think the power that Apple has, as opposed to others, I mean, they're technologically probably much better products, but there's still kind of a magic around it that comes from his LSD experiences. I'm totally convinced about this. I mean, he even says it by himself, kind of, right? Mm-hmm. So the question would be, if we need in the future, or like basically or since yesterday, if we need more creativity and new ideas than maybe profit, so eventually this would this be a reason why this therapy or this, I mean, you could also say it can be coaching, you know, coaching for C-level people or our employees, isn't that then anyway something that we definitely need much more than, let's say, new business models in the first place?
I love that question. One of the ways I've been thinking about that specifically is, you know, in the context of our study, right, a little bit too, which is why might creativity really matter, right? And yes, it can obviously really matter for business models and, you know, the bottom line and the like. And I think that's a pretty straightforward argument to make. But there's the other part, which is around the questions of, you know, the kinds of problems that executives are facing now. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, quite aside from the climate crisis and all of the other somewhat existential problems that we're facing now in the world, you know, the complexity of the challenges that, you know, leaders, particularly of larger organizations, are facing is unparalleled. And the number of pressures that they face, it's a really difficult place to navigate from. And so one could imagine, you know, thinking about the problem in that way, you know, the creativity and the solution being relevant for that. How does one navigate in that kind of environment with the challenges of, you know, all the different pulls? And then layer it over all the existential crises and that we're all being asked to navigate. which also affect business, right? It's affecting everything, supply chains, yeah. It's affecting yeah. inputs, it's affecting workforces, everything, right? So there's some interesting possibility there too, right? To think about in terms of, is that one of the mechanisms by which one might expect to also see, right? Some shifts in how they make decisions is because there's just different ways of even conceptualizing a problem.
Well, I mean, exactly. No, bad. Go ahead.
Well, no, I think that's a great answer, Rochelle. And I think it also links back to some of a little bit of what we were talking about at the beginning, this caricatured kind of old style of heroic leadership begins with the assumption that you have a master plan to direct others toward in the first place. Right. And that clearly is just completely implausible given the sheer level of complexity that we face today, as Rochelle was just saying. So what might evolve? Again, we don't know, but it seems that there is the potential for a fundamentally different type of leadership that doesn't operate that way, that doesn't actually operate according to a master plan and doesn't focus on just trying to direct others, but is more about, you know, if the key to facing these complex challenges is to have all the different parts of the system working together, then is it possible that a type of leadership might emerge that whose focus is on catalyzing the collective intelligence of the group, you know, versus telling everyone what to do? And so that too, I think, is another, you know, just another angle on all of this, or a related angle, I should say.
But so meaning, let's say with Ted Lasso, I mean, the insanely successful.
I didn't see it.
So he's a nice guy, right? That guy. I mean, and it's funny enough, now I can't say so much about Ted Lasso because I don't watch shows with nice guys in it. For me, I'm like, oh, that guy's so nice. But I mean, like, from my very few moments in leadership, where I was in a leadership position, it was always like exactly what you say, like bringing out in the group their possibility, or their allow the group to speak up, right? I mean, to say, although 90% of this group is saying this, I don't believe this is working, or this is what I don't like, although the rest of the group likes it. So this would be, let's say, an ideal outcome of a situation, right? And then the leader should say, well, okay, so let's look at this one little person there. What's that person saying? Maybe there's something to it. And not saying like, oh, you're this little person and the rest of the group is agreeing because for whatever reason they are agreeing. So that means also it's like a complete restructuring of leverage, right? Who has leverage? Who has something to say? Is there any hierarchy possible at all? Which, I mean, is a nice hippie idea, but not, we know that that always works. So, but even with a psychedelic experience, there will be, you know, even like after a trip, like in a group, if you share, there's always a couple of people who have the stronger story, the better story, and some people don't say anything. So this is something I always wonder, is this measurable, how the leverage is changing?
So by the leverage, do you mean like the power dynamics within an organization?
Yeah,
is that what you're talking about?
Power dynamics, yeah. So, I mean, like how one person is taken more serious than the other. So, which is, you know, a human condition, but it changes after a group, let's say, has done psychedelics together. So, and then how
do you... Oh, so you're talking more about the group experience.
Yeah, I mean, it's just why we're talking. Okay. I'm thinking about it. And it's like, this is what happens. Let's say you could say a group before psychedelics and a group after psychedelics will be a different power dynamics. So, and then you have to adjust as a leader to this.
But I'll just share. I mean, I think there are actually a couple of threads we could pull here. But, you know, one of the kind of initial insights from our pilot research that we did was that most of the people in the group felt that after they had the experience together, felt that ego tensions were less of an issue, ego tensions with others in the group. And there are other types of measures. That's just one example. There are other types of measures of group cohesion that can also be used to kind of get at that idea. So, yeah, so I just wanted to offer it because you were asking direct. I think you were asking about, are we measuring this? Is there a way to look at this?
And yeah.
I think for sure there's a way to measure it. I'll add one more kind of broader point. We were talking earlier about regenerative systems. And if we look at the way that, living systems work in nature, I mean, imagine a forest, all the different members of the forest, the trees, the soil, the various animals, they all have their own unique essence. And when they're all able to express their unique essence and play their unique role in the system, that's what allows the system to thrive. That's what creates harmony. And so I think we could, again, if we want to kind of apply some of these ideas to organizations, I think maybe what we're talking about is the type of leadership that is capable of supporting others and expressing their true essence and, playing their unique role. It goes back to this idea of empowered participation that we were talking about earlier, when every element of the system is doing its thing, the whole system's better off. Anyway, I'm sure you probably have more to say, but those are my initial thoughts.
No, it's like a beautiful segue into, what I was going to bring up. So I was going to go back to Ted Lasso.
Well, it's great. So, everybody knows it besides me.
I just watched the show now.
Well, neither of you do, though. So, I'm sure you could Google Ted Lasso isms, but but what Bennett you just described is kind of very similar to his style of leadership. He's not focused on winning the games. He's focused on, kind of like the realization of each of his players, like emotional, social well-being. And, sort of use it as, I'm simplifying, of course, that the team will then take care of itself if each of these parts are kind of, able to step into their fullest versions of themselves. And what's interesting in that, and this is something I've been sitting with a lot and I don't know the answer to it, is that, Ted Lasso is still clearly very much a leader, right? And there's still some authority with him, right? He does make the calls, but the way that he does it, he's much more participatory and much more focused on the well-being of all the parts than, say, succession style leadership, from what I understand you're saying. And maybe that's part of the system in the same way, like in a forest, they have now, scientists are finding they have what's called a mother tree, right? Mm-hmm. Which, does more of kind of the sending out of resources and communications and nurturing other parts of the forest, so there's these kind of focal, and maybe Ted Lasso is in that same way. So it's, we could put a layer upon someone like Ted Lasso and, say, leader. And they are, and he is, but it's in a very different way. We may, as a society, project on him and put him in the same bucket as a succession leader, but he is a very different style, right? But it's still, there's still power in it. Decision-making authority. And that maybe that still needs to be there in the same way, that we're not just talking about a totally flat leaderless organization, that maybe there still is some of that, but it's just very shifted. And I don't know, I think there's probably a lot of different flavors and ways to do this.
I think that Taylor Swift is a leader too, under these conditions.
Yeah.
Which she is. Yeah. I mean, and people are like already, okay, can we now not see anymore these pictures of her? But it's like, no. People want to see her. I'm sure also not only women. Obviously, she helped the Super Bowl with the viewers. So, I mean, it's very interesting. Like when you talked about Ted Lasso, to my mind came actually Taylor Swift. And even if you, not necessarily the music, so, but I mean, sure, that too, but just her way of being open to, you know, reacting to her fans in a way where she says, well, you know, when this one fan died, she was like, okay, this is really like addressing it. And then of course people would say like, yeah, yeah, that's just PR, but I don't think this is no longer a question of like good PR or bad PR. And I think even like really big stars now are the make it or break it thing is if they're authentic leaders or not to a generation of people. So
yeah, authenticity. Yeah, that is central to it.
So mm-hmm. when this study is done in probably how long will it take? A couple of years, right? I guess. We don't know yet.
What a good question.
Okay, but when it's done, let's say fast forward in, let's say 2 years, something. So how would be your ideal outcome to, what should it show to people in really kind of Fortune 500 companies by then?
I think it's, what I would love to see is kind of a whether and when does this work in terms of how, like so that we would have an answer to the question, does it actually shift decision-making in meaningful ways? And we can identify that in a scientific manner, right? You know, and what I mean by that is, you know, with statistical rigor and the usual research bells and whistles. But then another part, which we're both super curious about, is the arc of that path, what that actually looks like and how it manifests in different ways, depending on context, as well as sort of the starting conditions that change those trajectories. So can we say something about, you know, the baseline where people, you know, we capture certain people and that, you know, it's sort of like what's going on with kind of DNA work, right? If you have a particular DNA profile, you know, this kind of diet will work better than this other kind of diet, right? And so one could imagine that, you know, this sort of experience, this consciousness expanding experience in a well-held setting is particularly changing for these types of individuals or in these sorts of organizations and less so in this, right? Because it's, I don't think it's going to be a one size fits all. And so to the extent that we can really identify that, those differences in a meaningful, thoughtful way, I'd be thrilled.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. Actually, I think psychedelic research in general, including research that's more in the clinical space, is moving in this direction anyway. And so another piece of that, and maybe this is for like the next study or phase two of this study, another piece of that could be not just for which types of people will this have more or less impact, but also what types of facilitation, maybe even what types of substances are more well suited to people coming into it, you know, with who come into it very different profiles. And one of the if we think about somebody's profile, one of the elements of that could be in where they are, in where they already are in their journey of consciousness expansion. I mean, some people may come into the study with having done very little prior consciousness expanding work. And when I say consciousness expanding, I'm not just talking about have they taken psychedelics before. But people, you know, some people have are on a path, have done a lot of meditation and been involved with mindfulness, and other people, you know, there's just various types of spiritual practices and just a whole set of practices that can, you know, that can result in people's being at very different places. So that's all that I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, the substance is definitely going to be important. I mean, a very interesting topic. Like, what are you going to do for team building? Will you host a rave for 20 people and everybody's doing MDMA? Or will you have a weekend in nature with a small dose of psilocybin? I mean, there are all kinds of new, I mean, it sounds like we're making fun of it now, but it is kind of very team building. in a way that people are opening up to each other in a very different way and just don't feel ashamed to say like, oh, I sometimes feel so-and-so. And the other person's like, what? Mm-hmm. I never thought you would be that person. I always think you're so, with your Harvard degree, and I think you're, I always think you're super intelligent. And the other person, no, but I feel like shit sometimes. So it's a very interesting dynamic that could start in collaborations also with people.
And that's also an element of what we're looking at, because, and I think we've been alluding to this, but maybe haven't said it so explicitly.
Yeah.
The psilocybin experience itself in the current phase of the study is done in, it's in a group format in a retreat setting. And the participants, at least some cohorts, spend a significant amount of time together in a group setting online, both before and afterwards. So one of the aspects that we're looking at is, you know, whether and how this the group setting affects the experience. And there's so that's just one of the questions that we're looking at as well.
Yeah, and if I can add to that too, you know, and we're currently recruiting for a couple of cohorts this year for the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. But you know, one of the things that we're discussing too is, yeah, I don't think this project is kind of a one and done for Bennett and myself. We have so many questions, and even the one you mentioned about doing something that's more nature based.
Yeah,
trying different substance. Does that matter? Maybe even doing breath work. Right. Instead of any substance. Right. Mm-hmm. So there's many different ways that we're kind of thinking about different slices of this. But right now we're very focused on the psilocybin based studies with the group cohorts in the Netherlands, with the program as Bennett's described. And there's this kind of coaching container around it that we're currently recruiting for. And so hopefully we'll have some good results to talk about sometime in the coming year.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, we keep on our newsletter, we keep everybody updated for like, if you're interested in being part of this. So thank you guys for being on the show. Great.
Thank you so much, Anne.
It looks like we need to invite Ted Lasso.
Thank you.
And Taylor Swift. And the guy from Succession. What's his name again? But I always forget about him. Don Draper, of course. I mean, it would be really interesting if these characters could do psychedelics. Yeah. So
who knows?
Who knows? It's all in the making. So there's definitely will be a second episode that we have to record with you guys when the study has progressed a little bit. And thank you for being on the show. Super interesting.
Thanks for the invitation. It's been a really fun conversation.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it too.
Yeah.
Hey, and thank you for listening to this episode. Since I have you here, I just wanted to remind you, please follow us on Instagram, The New Health Club, on X, The New Health CL1, on LinkedIn, and please subscribe to our newsletter on Substack. I'm very happy if you are a returning listener and customer and fan of the New Health Club.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.